Revelation 2, verses 12 through 17, let us give our attention to the Word of the living God. And to the angel of the church in Pergamos write, "These things says he who has the sharp two-edged sword. I know your works, and where you dwell, where Satan's throne is. And you hold fast to my name, and did not deny my faith, even in the days in which Antipas was my faithful martyr, who was killed among you, where Satan dwells. But I have a few things against you, because you have there those who hold the doctrine of Balaam, who taught Balak to put a stumbling block before the children of Israel, to eat things sacrificed to idols, and to commit sexual immorality. Thus you also have those who hold the doctrine of the Nicolaitans, which thing I hate. Repent, or else I will come to you quickly, and will fight against them with the sword of my mouth. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To him who overcomes, I will give some of the hidden manna to eat, and I will give him a white stone, and on the stone a new name written, which no one knows except him who receives it." So far, the reading of God's own word. People of God, there is not a square inch in heaven or on earth or under the earth in which there is peace between Christ and Satan. Not a square inch in heaven or on earth or under the earth in which there is peace between Christ and Satan. Those were the words that Abraham Kuyper used to describe that spiritual warfare in which we are engaged. It is the same warfare that is described by the Apostle Paul in Ephesians chapter 6, where he tells us that our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against rulers, against authorities, against the powers of this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms. It is this battle. It is this warfare that is set before us also this evening in our passage, Revelation 2, verses 12 through 17. Note that it is a battle in which each one of us is engaged. It is our struggle, the Apostle Paul says. It is we who struggle in this warfare. It is we who struggle in this battle. It is we who participate in this warfare in the spiritual realm. We are participants in the action. Recall what we have said about the seven letters to the seven churches of Asia Minor. Just briefly, we have stated that the book of Revelation consists of seven sections. Each of those seven sections spanning the same period of time from Christ's first coming to his last coming. Revelation chapter 1 through 3 is the first of those seven sections. It spans that time period. And as such, what we have then in Revelation 2 through 3 in the seven letters is a composite picture of the church in the world from the time of Christ's first coming to the time of his second coming. That means, beloved, that what we have in these seven letters to the seven churches is not merely an historical document that describes the condition of the church in the first century. Nor do we merely have here in these seven letters to the seven churches, and in the entire book of Revelation for that matter, a description of those events that shall transpire just prior to the second coming of Christ. What we have here in the entire book of Revelation, and what we have here in these seven letters to the seven churches, is a description of the church in the world, even as we know it today. These letters are describing us.
As I have said before, we are not mere spectators sitting in the stands watching the action and the events of the book of Revelation unfold before our eyes. The book of Revelation grabs hold of us. It brings us down into the arena that we ourselves may participate in that action. The history that is being described here is our history. We belong to the church in the world, even as she awaits her eternal rest. We are participants in this battle, participants in this warfare. Well, with that said, let us turn our attention to the words of Christ here in Revelation chapter 2. He begins in verse 12, "To the angel of the church in Pergamos write, these things says he who has the sharp two-edged sword. I know your works and where you dwell, where Satan's throne is. And you hold fast to my name and did not deny my faith, even in the days in which Antipas was my faithful martyr, who was killed among you, where Satan dwells." Two times in verse 13, Christ identifies the city of Pergamos as the place where Satan has his throne, as the place where Satan dwells. And we may well ask the question tonight, what is it that would lead Christ to identify Pergamos as the place of Satan's throne, as the place where Satan dwells? Well, to answer that question, we must know something of the city of Pergamos. Pergamos was a very important and very influential city in Asia Minor. In fact, Pergamos was the Roman capital of Asia Minor. In other words, it was from the city of Pergamos that the great and vast and mighty Roman Empire sought to govern that whole region of Asia Minor. And so special privileges and special powers were granted to the government there in Pergamos. One of the special privileges, one of the special powers, was what was called the right of the sword. The governor in Pergamos had the right of the sword. That is to say, he alone had the right in that city to determine who lives and who dies. He had the right of the sword. Now, as Pergamos was the capital of the Roman province of Asia Minor, it was a city that was very fervent and very zealous for the honor and dignity of Caesar. It too engaged in the imperial cult. It bowed the knee. It worshipped Caesar as God. You can well imagine that this city too would be zealous to maintain its reputation as the capital of the Roman Empire in Asia Minor. And it would be quick and it would be zealous in the persecution of any who would not bow the knee to Caesar. Indeed, persecution was turned up against the Christians in Pergamos. Now, it may be one thing to remain faithful in the face of hostility. It may be quite another thing to remain faithful in the face of imprisonment. But certainly it is a far greater thing to remain faithful when the sword is held at your neck, knowing full well that if you renounce Christ, you will go free and live. But if you fail to do so, the sword will surely find its mark. This was the persecution that came against the Christians of Pergamos. In fact, one of the martyrs is even named here, a man by the name of Antipas, put to death because he would not bow the knee to Caesar. The sword found its mark, and he paid the ultimate price. In a city where Caesar was Lord, in a city where Caesar was considered God, is it any wonder that Pergamos was called the throne of Satan, the place where Satan dwells? Pergamos further was a city, like many of the cities of the Roman Empire, in which the worship of the Greek gods was prevalent. A whole host of Greek gods were worshipped there in the city of Pergamos. Among them was the god Dionysius. The worship of the god Dionysius consisted in the eating of raw meat that had been offered to this god. And as the worshippers of Dionysius would eat of this raw meat, they would also drink much wine, which would lead to sexual immorality. So great was the sexual immorality of the city of Pergamos, of the worshippers of Dionysius, that the people would run through the hills naked, crying out a whole host of things and engaging in all sorts of pagan revelry. Revelry that was so perverse that even the immoral Roman Empire would outlaw it. With such pagan practices, is it any wonder that Pergamos was called the throne of Satan? Other gods were worshipped there as well. There was the god Asclepius, whom one author describes in this way: Pergamos was famous for its worship of Asclepius as its chief god. Characteristic of this god was that its chief symbol representing him was that of the serpent, the symbol also of the devil. The special power attributed to this god was that he could save people from the miserable effects of sin, from disease and sickness of all kinds. People from the city and from all the surrounding country flocked to his temple for help and recovery. And because of this imaginary power of this god, he was generally known as Soter, that is, Savior. Thus we obtain indeed a striking symbolism of the power of Antichrist and the dominion of Satan, consisting ultimately of this, that the serpent, the very symbol of the devil, was hailed as the Savior of man and was worshipped as such. Archaeological excavations have uncovered Pergamenian coins in which the Roman emperor is seen standing before a serpent with his hand raised high in salute to that serpent, much like Hitler's Nazis would later salute him. Indeed, is it any wonder that this city was called the throne of Satan? A whole host of other Greek gods were worshipped there as well. There was Demeter, there was Athena, there was Zeus. Yes, even Zeus. There was a great and magnificent temple built to the god Zeus on the highest point of the city of Pergamos, overlooking the bay. Considering all the worship of these false gods that had Satan behind them, is it any wonder that Christ would call Pergamos the throne of Satan? And yet, dear friends, we would miss the point. We would miss the point if we were to walk away this evening saying simply this: what a terrible place the city of Pergamos must have been. What a terrible place where people would eat raw meat, where they would drink wine to the point of great and vast sexual immorality and perversion. What a terrible and wicked city that would bow the knee to a man and proclaim him as God. What a terrible city in which Christians were persecuted and put to death for the faith. What a terrible place must Pergamos have been that it would be called the throne of Satan. If that were our conclusion this evening, we would miss the point. For dear friends, are these things not true of the world in which we live? Is not Satan called the Prince of Darkness? Is Satan not called the Prince of the Rulers of the Air? Is not Satan called the Prince of the Power of the Air? And does not Satan also have his throne here in this present fallen world? In fact, is not Satan hailed as the king?
wherever Christ is rejected as king. There is not a square inch in heaven or on earth or under the earth in which there is peace between Christ and Satan. Not a square inch in which there is peace between the kingdom of Christ and the kingdom of Satan. There is no neutral ground, beloved. No neutral ground in this battle. There is no third way. Either it belongs to the kingdom of Christ or it belongs to the kingdom of Satan. It was what the great apologist Cornelius Vintil said. There are no brute facts. There is nothing neutral. Do you understand something of the warfare in which we are engaged? Do you understand something of the battle in which we are engaged? And has not Satan tricked us into thinking that indeed things are neutral? Has he not tricked us to go to the workplace tomorrow morning and think that the workplace is a neutral environment? Has he not tricked you young people into thinking that the entertainment that you set before your eyes is a neutral thing? That you can somehow just leave Jesus behind, that you can drop your guard, and that you can allow your mind to be filled with the filth of this world? There is no neutral ground. Either it belongs to the kingdom of Christ or it belongs to the kingdom of Satan. There is no other option. And dear friends, we need to be mindful of such things. Young people, you need to be mindful of such things. When you go to the movies, what you are watching there on the big screen belongs either to the kingdom of Christ or to the kingdom of Satan. You go to the popular movie today, The Planet of the Apes. You see a movie there which is not neutral. Man is depicted in subservience to apes. It is a subversion of God's created order. You turn on the television set and you watch it, parents, with your children during the prime time hour. The family hour, as it used to be called. And you see marriage made a mockery of. And you see homosexuality portrayed as something acceptable. It is not neutral. It is a subversion of God's created order. You turn on the radio and you listen to the songs that are aired over the radio waves. And you listen to violence and sexual immorality, which is exalted and portrayed as something good. These things are not neutral. You read the books that are being published by the world today, and indeed you see in these things as well. They are not neutral. The series which is so popular among the children of our world today, the Harry Potter series, these things are not neutral, beloved. When evil is called good and good is called evil, these things are not neutral. When we can be tricked into thinking that an author such as Madeleine L'Engle is a Christian author who advocates New Age, do you not begin to see the power of the evil one in drawing even Christians into thinking that we can drop our guard? Peter tells us that our enemy, the devil, loves to prowl about as a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. And he works through the institutions of this world. He works through those things that have been established in this world to draw you in, to claim your mind, to claim your heart, to claim your soul. Now, beloved, please understand me. I'm not advocating that we all become monks and nuns and
and move out into the desert, into monasteries. We are in the world, but we are not of the world. What I'm saying is this: we must live with an awareness of the world in which we live. We must live with an awareness that the kingdom of Satan is real, that it is strong, that it is powerful, and that if left to ourselves, we are no match. As Christians, and especially as Christian young people, we must live with our eyes wide open to the world in which we live. We must understand the warfare in which we are engaged. We must understand the battle in which we are engaged. Our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the powers of this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms. There is not a square inch of neutrality. Your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. Paul tells us in the letter to the Corinthians that he loves to masquerade as an angel of light. Indeed, one of Satan's greatest ploys is to get you to believe that everything is neutral, that there is no harm in the things of his kingdom, that you can watch all of the violence and the sexual immorality in the movies and on the TV, that you can listen to it on the radio, that you can read of it in books, and that it will have no effect on your heart. Should not the condition of our culture convince us otherwise? Satan loves to masquerade as an angel of light. Slowly he wraps his coils around you. Slowly he tightens those coils, squeezing the life from you. So slowly and so subtly that before you know it, you're comfortable in your sin. Consider it in your own life, beloved. Consider the things that you are allowing into your home through the television set. Things that you would never dream of talking about in the presence of your children. Things that you would never want your children to see, yet you allow it into your homes. How quickly we become comfortable in our sin. How quickly we lose our ability to blush over our sin. We watch things in the movies. We watch things on the television shows. We listen to things in the radio. We read books. And ever so slowly, that great serpent of old causes us to become numb to the wickedness and the sinfulness that surrounds. We are living, beloved, where Satan dwells, where Satan has his throne, and he is at work. Indeed, the danger to compromise with the kingdom of Satan is great. The church in Pergamos evidently remained strong in the face of persecution, according to verses 12 and 13. They were well aware of that warfare in the world. But a greater danger faced the church in Pergamos. Though they were well aware of the warfare and the battle that engages in the world between the kingdom of Christ and the kingdom of Satan, it seems as though
They were not awake to the fact, the sobering fact, that that warfare exists also in the church. In fact, it is in the church where Satan works hardest. It is in the church where he is most subtle. It is in the church that Satan seeks to do his worst. Slowly the church in Pergamos, this church in the world, allowed the world into the church. Slowly they allowed compromise within. Christ himself rebukes the church for such things in verses 14 and 15. I have a few things against you, he says, because you have there those who hold the doctrine of Balaam, who taught Balak to put a stumbling block before the children of Israel, to eat things sacrificed to idols, and to commit sexual immorality. Thus you also have those who hold the doctrine of the Nicolaitans, which thing I hate. Very interesting that Christ would speak here of the doctrine of Balaam. Boys and girls, I'm sure you remember the story of Balaam in Numbers 22 through 24. It was Balaam, you recall, who had his donkey speak to him. As Balak, the king of Moab, sought to entice Balaam to come and to place the curse of God upon the Israelites. And indeed, as we read the story of Balaam there in chapters 22 through 24 of Numbers, it seems as though Balaam appears as a very righteous man. But read on in the book of Numbers. Balaam disappears from the scene at the end of Numbers 24. The very next thing we read in Numbers 25 is that the children of Israel joined together with the children of Moab, that they began to eat meat sacrificed to the idols and to the false gods of Moab, that they began to engage in sexual immorality with the women of Moab. And only later do we read in Numbers 31, in 2 Peter, and also in the book of Jude, that it was Balaam himself who enticed the children of Israel to engage in these sinful practices. Now we are told that there in Pergamos there were those who held to the doctrine of Balaam, and that these people were in the church. What are we to make of it? Well, you notice that it is explicitly mentioned here in the text that there were those among them who were eating things sacrificed to idols and committing sexual immorality. Remember Dionysius? The worship of Dionysius consisted in the eating of raw meat offered to idols and engaging in sexual immorality. You begin to get something of the picture. Evidently, there were those among the church in Pergamos who were saying to the Christians in the church, rather than face death, rather than face persecution, let us compromise a little bit here. Let us compromise a little bit there. Let us engage with those of the city who eat those raw meats offered to idols. Let us engage with those of the city who engage in sexual immorality. Indeed, is that not better to preserve our life? Surely a little compromise won't hurt. And after all, as we begin to build bridges with these pagans, maybe we can be an influence for good. A little compromise won't hurt, said those who held to the doctrine of Balaam. The temptation was indeed great to compromise a bit here, to compromise a bit there. The greatness of the temptation is hinted at in the names that Christ chooses. In verse 15, we read of the Nicolaitans. We know not much about them. But we know the etymology of the name Nicolaitan. It comes from two Greek words, the Greek verb niko, meaning to conquer, and the Greek noun laos, meaning the people. Nicolaitan then means he conquers the people. Do you see the danger? Do you see the greatness of the temptation? We see it also in the etymology of the name Balaam. In rabbinic literature, the name Balaam has its etymology to mean he who consumes the people. Do you see the danger? Do you see the greatness of the temptation that was there in the church of Pergamos? These false doctrines, these compromises were beginning to conquer the people of God. They were beginning to consume the people of God. Christ Himself stands before the church and says, I hate such things.
Wolves were infiltrating the flock, dressed in sheep's clothing. And they were conquering and consuming the church. Indeed, it is a most difficult thing once one has started down the path of compromise to turn back to the path of orthodoxy. We see it in our own lives. We see it in our own experiences. We start with a little tiny sin. Not satisfied with that, we take the next step. Not satisfied with that, we take the next step. Not satisfied with that, we take the next step. As Psalm 1 says, we begin by walking in the counsel of the wicked. We move to standing in the way of sinners, and before we know it, we are sitting perfectly at home in the seat of mockers. We become like the chaff that is driven away as we lose our ability to blush over our sin. We find ourselves at the end of our rope and we wonder how we've gotten there. Step by step by step. A little compromise here and a little compromise there. We see it in our own lives. We see it in the history of denominations. Survey the list of denominations in this land over the last 200 to 300 years. And there is only a very small handful of those that have walked the path of liberalism who by God's grace are restored to the path of orthodoxy. You begin that path. And it's nigh to impossible to return to the proper path. This was the danger facing the church of Pergamos. It is also, beloved, the danger facing the church of our day. Yes, Satan and his minions have darkened the door of the church. They have slithered into the pews. They have slithered into the pulpits of our land. And ever so slowly, the church makes her compromises. So that the church in the world today, in large measure, resembles little more than an entertainment industry run like a business. Be not mistaken, beloved. Satan is real. He is active. He is powerful. His kingdom is strong and increasing in strength and number. And the most powerful of his attacks are leveled against the church. Satan knows enough to let lying dogs sleep. And so it follows that the faithful church shall be a persecuted church. You know the old saying that where Christ builds a church, Satan builds a chapel right alongside. Are we aware of the fact, beloved, that we live
where Satan dwells, where he has his throne. Do you see what Satan has done? Oh, indeed, he has won. Many a victory in our land. I was listening this morning on my way after church to the hospital to Dr. Cray as he was preaching at Seventh Reformed, and he was preaching about the work and the operations of Satan in the world, and he was listing off many of the victories of Satan in this world against the church. Satan has won a victory as he has taken away the Sabbath day from God's people. Satan has won a victory as the church is now more concerned with entertaining the people than it is with proclaiming the whole counsel of God. Satan has won a victory as we think that these things matter not. Do you see what Satan has done? This past week, I read an article in the latest issue of the Banner of Truth, an article written by Maurice Roberts, the editor of that periodical, entitled The War of the Worlds. It struck me as he described in very vivid detail the work of the Prince of Darkness. I quote at that article at some length because he describes it in far greater detail than I. He writes, "The souls of men, of all men, are the object of Satan's jealousy and vigilance. He looks on them as his possession, and he keeps them under lock and key. It is this dire and terrible truth that makes this world the sad place it is. Human freedom is a myth and a lie. Sinners are no more free to escape from sin than men in a dungeon are free to walk in the grounds of the castle where they are being held. Sinners are kept in their place by a mighty spiritual agency of unceasing vigilance. No poor Jewish prisoner in his concentration camp at Auschwitz was ever more closely guarded than are sinners of this world by their spiritual jailer. Satan sees to it that sinners are held securely in their dark bondage and in their ignorance of God. The armor of Satan, like himself, is invisible, yet deadly. As the spider holds the fly by its web, so Satan holds men to their slavery in his hateful kingdom. His armor is the great system of deception which prevails in this world. Over the centuries, Satan has been redecorating the rooms of God's beautiful creation so as to efface all reference to its maker and its judge. From the cradle to the grave, Satan is at pains to brainwash poor sinners with the lie of atheism or humanism or else corrupt Christianity. As a murderer from the beginning and as a liar and the father of it, Satan has blinded the generations one by one as far as he was permitted, lest the light of the glorious gospel of Christ should shine unto them. What were the pantheon of Babylon, or the mythology of Greece and Rome, or the superstitions of the Middle Ages, but just so many great deceptions of Satan to keep his goods secure in his palace? And what today are the many false and misleading philosophies and corrupt and unbiblical religious traditions, but so many chains by which men are enslaved to darkness and held back from the light of God's glorious gospel. Satan's great skill is seen in the way in which he holds men down by the very throat, yet at the same time deceives them into convincing themselves that they are all the time in a peaceful and good condition.